Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the largest segment of society. To those who are smart enough to realize that all, every single one of the world's political, religious, military, economic, judicial, and media institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our phone number, if you would like to participate in this discussion anytime over the next 3 hours, is 877-300-7645. We will begin, of course, in Ferguson, the suburb of St. Louis, Missouri, heartland of America. The grand jury did what was predictable. At least it became predictable once we had more evidence than the childish autopsy done at the behest of the Brown family, actually by African-American activists, where he took a very crude illustration and again, crudely put a dot where there was an entry or exit wound of a bullet, but one that was really incapable of conveying anything meaningful. And when I looked at that autopsy report, the first thing is that, the way that it's drawn here, the only conclusions you can come to is the man had his hands down by his side, and that the first wound was through the thumb and then moved up to the top of the head as the gun rose through its percussive force. And it looked pretty bad for Wilson in terms of that autopsy. But after that time, things changed. And about 2 weeks ago, things changed radically because we were given much more information. The autopsy information from the two that were public autopsies showed a very different result, that all of those who had testified that Brown was trying to surrender had lied. All of those who testified that Officer Wilson was standing over Brown, shooting him at point-blank range in the back, first as he tried to retreat and then standing over him and firing multiple rounds into his back, they were wrong. The notion that Brown was trying to surrender and that he was shot while his hands were up in the air trying to surrender, that two public autopsies demonstrated conclusively that those witnesses lied. And so 2 weeks ago, it became obvious that there would be no grounds for murder, first degree, second degree, third degree, and even homicide. The ideas of endangerment and of manslaughter without premeditation, it wasn't going to happen. There just wasn't going to be an indictment. Now, I had shared on this program that I had a concern over that. And I had two concerns, actually. One was that the reason this thing had grown so out of control, with so many people making so many stupid statements and stirring people up, was because the overwhelming preponderance of the evidence was not released, though it was last night. And had the evidence been released earlier, then there would have been no riots, because those rioting aren't rioting because they're incensed. They aren't thinking. This is about justice for them. It's about who they are. But we'll talk about that in a moment. And so It looked like a lose-lose scenario to me. If they indict this man when clearly he should not be indicted based upon the evidence that we were privy to as of 2 weeks ago, then he was going to have to defend himself at great cost, and the trial would go on and on, but at least we would get access to all of the information so we could review it and come to our own conclusions. And if he was not indicted, which seemed like the rational thing to do based upon what we were learning, then I was afraid that we were never going to have access to all of the data that is required to ascertain the truth in this case. But we learned two things last night. The man who made the presentation said that there has been frustration and not being able to get information out, because he says most of that which is in the news and is being reported is untrue. And we knew it to be untrue. But he said the reason we did not release information to correct the record was that it was the best litmus test for the grand jury to determine what witnesses to trust. He said the moment that facts became evident, that the witnesses who were more jaundiced, who really were witnesses on behalf of a cause as opposed to on behalf of what actually occurred, changed their story so that their story was more consistent with the evidence. But if they're not allowed that opportunity, and then the grand jury has the opportunity to see, to view each person's testimony vis-a-vis the actual forensic evidence, then they can determine who to trust as opposed to witnesses changing their story so that it's more consistent with the evidence. Well, that makes some sense. Now, I think that the trade-off here, in terms of the public benefiting from knowing versus the grand jury benefiting from recognizing false testimony, I would err strongly on the side of the public has a right to know. So I think that St. Louis and Ferguson, Missouri, erred in that regard, but at least they explained the reason for their error. It was a rational decision. I think they just came to the wrong conclusion. But I'm glad to know that there was a thought process here. But the thing that I was surprised by and very pleased by was that after this civil servant last night went through, representative of the Justice Department went through what transpired, he said, we're going to release all of the information that the grand jury was privy to, all of it. 60 witnesses, 70 hours of testimony, 3 autopsies, and enormous amounts of forensic evidence. We're going to give it all to you. And they did. Now, I'm not going to tell you that I have read through and studied all of it, because I don't think there's any reason to. I listened last night, as I'm sure many of you did, at least before the riots, at least before the ignoramus that we have as President of the United States spoke, to a civil servant that actually made some sense. He spoke of the grand jury process, of those who were on the grand jury, of the fact that they volunteered to stay on past their end of August conclusion of their service time, that they met on 25 different days just regarding this case. 25 days of their time that they listened to the evidence of 60 different witnesses and cross-examined them, asked them questions. 70 hours of testimony, a mountain of forensic evidence. And what they ultimately did is made a decision as to who to trust based upon how well their statements either matched or failed to match the forensic evidence. The forensic evidence does not lie. People do. And as he went through the process that they used to come to their conclusions and the time they invested into it and the witnesses they considered, it was overwhelming that there was absolutely no basis for an indictment here, which troubles me greatly that the jerk we have for President of the United States and his incompetent and moronic attorney general, who has admitted publicly that his course as attorney general is guided primarily by politics, has decided to continue the federal civil rights investigation. Listen, race is irrelevant in this case. Race was never relevant in this case. And to assume that a man who was being attacked made a decision to shoot and kill because the man attacking him was black versus Hispanic versus Chinese versus Caucasian is ludicrous. If the grand jury found no basis of an indictment for even the lowest level of manslaughter, race is absolutely irrelevant. If the Obaminator had a conscience, if he was a moral individual, he would have announced that last night, but he didn't. No. He said that the anger and rage and disappointment was understandable. No, it's not. No, it's not. You know, in the case of Ferguson, race was irrelevant. In the case of Ferguson, there was no tragedy that took place there. There was no victim in Ferguson. This young man got high on marijuana. He went to steal cigars that were used to concentrate his high, to facilitate his ongoing high. He stole them, robbed a convenience store, assaulted its owner, and then was walking down the middle of the street, cocky as all get out. First story is Dateline, Clayton, Missouri. Protesters quickly turned violent in the Ferguson, Missouri area after the decision was announced not to indict by the grand jury. Now, what's amazing here is just how violent they became. They burnt down 12 to 18 buildings. They looted that many stores. They shot, the police counted several hundred rounds of ammunition. Police shot none. Several hundred rounds of ammunition torched 12 to 18 stores, looted them, turned over and vandalized cars. They were thugs. This is a day where the President of the United States, rather than saying that there is reason for them to be angry, should have said just the opposite. This is a day where the President of the United States, rather than saying that somehow in communities of color, justice doesn't feel fair, should have said just the opposite. It is time we look in the mirror, America. The African American community has a problem. Now, what happened in Ferguson many months ago with the shoplifter walking down the street and swearing at and then attacking the police officer and getting himself killed in the process, was no racism involved in that crime. The aftermath is pure racism. And the problem exists within the African American community wholly and completely. The statistics nationally are well known. I've discussed them on this program. The reality is that if an African American is killed, murdered, 93% of the time, 9 times out of 10, his murderer will be a African American. Now that's stunning when you consider that African Americans represent 12 to 15% of the American population. And yet, more than 9 times out of 10, if an African American is killed, murdered, the murderer will be a African American. The fact is that there is black on white crime and white on black crime, although most blacks kill blacks. Most whites kill whites. But when blacks and whites tangle and one robs, rapes, or kills the other, 8 times in 10, the victim is white and the perpetrator is black. Those are stunning revelations. There is a problem, America, and we need to deal with this problem. Now, before we're there, we have Glenn on the line. I'd like to hear what Glenn has to say. We're going to spend more time considering what took place in Ferguson and why we have such an enormous problem in the African-American community. Hello, Glenn.
Hello, Yada. Yeah, not that that isn't important, absolutely, but I feel like it's being used as a tool. I would suggest if you look at the structure of human society, of the individual, the family, municipal government, mm-hmm. county government, state government, national government, and the internationalists. Mm-hmm. Now, mm-hmm. if you look at this, I'm seeing municipal police officers with federally provided vehicles and having, involved in this Ferguson situation, with the National Guard being almost absent, except in certain key locations. The Governor Nixon is in cahoots with the feds. Okay, shame on him. This should have been kept at the state's right, state management level. The feds shouldn't be involved in this. But again, just as with the Ebola situation, we see this blocking here. See this challenging of state's rights in order to cede authority and power to the Fed. And then above and beyond them, on December 24th, we have the UN issuing a treaty to deprive all private parties of personal firearms ownership. Basically, this all, ultimately, whether it's Ebola or Ferguson, everything has to do with ever greater centralization of power, at first at the federal level and then at the globalist level.
All right, we have the music, Glenn. I am going to say that while I think the issues within the African-American community and the rioting last night are important, I would agree that your perspective on the centralization of power and the arming of that power in America is as big, if not bigger, an issue. And that's also what we're witnessing here. To shattering this, we have Glenn with us, having made a point that is the same as my original point on Ferguson. In fact, it's something that Glenn and I had talked about on the air, that we are militarizing America. We've become a military state. And there's a lot of things that we can talk about in that regard. We also have Larry with us. But before Larry, before you contribute here, let me share a stunning statistic, because I am of the belief that for the most part, the judicial system in America is now gamed by the federal government, and that the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Department of Justice, and the FBI are as corrupt as any institution in this country. Over the past few decades, the U.S. Attorney's Office, that would be the Department of Justice, has prosecuted 162,500 cases where they brought their case to a grand jury seeking an indictment. 162,500 times Department of Justice prosecuted this case. You know how many times of those 162,500 times that the grand jury voted not to indict the individual that the Department of Justice wanted indicted? Since we have quiet from both of our guests here, I'm going to answer the question.
Larry said 100% of the time.
Very close. It's 11. 11. 11 times. That means of the 162,500 cases prosecuted by the Department of Justice, the grand jury voted to indict the individual 162,489 times.
Yeah, they're in control. I mean, it's right out there.
They are absolutely in control. So if there is one glimmer of hope in all of this, it's that civil servant that came out and systematically provided us with all of the information we needed to recognize that there was no crime that was perpetrated here, and that the grand jury had done his job. That was point one that was good, the fact he released all of the information that night. That was point two we should be celebrating, and point three is there are 12 people in this country that will stand up to the federal government.
More than 12. It was a grand jury, so it was 24.
No, it was only 12. I was wrong. In most states, a grand jury is 24 people. In this particular grand jury, it was 12. And grand juries, by the way, can vary in number from 12 to 24. And typically, they're 24. They were always 24 back in the day that I was most engaged in the process. But this one was 12. There were the breakdown, I think, was 9 men, 3 women, and it was 3 African Americans, 9 Caucasians, as I understand it. But from my perspective, race is irrelevant in the composition of the grand jury, and race was irrelevant in the incidents that took place in Ferguson.
You know, I paid pretty close attention to what happened there just last night, to be honest with you. I mean, I saw what had happened in the scar thief. But apparently he tried to wrestle the gun away from the cop to start with, and he got shot in the hand. And then he was coming back with his hands raised. Well, you know, at that point wasn't going to let that monster get within 2 feet of him. And I'm sure he was telling him to stop. And anybody else in that position, I would have shot him. I would have shot him. I can tell you that. I would have shot him. But Ferguson, Missouri does teach us another lesson, a couple lessons. First of all, nothing says I care more for a dead kid than 50 pairs of Air Jordans and burning a store to the ground. And also, it's taught us that don't expect police to protect you, your property, your means of production. You better be armed rather than wait for a bunch of impotent men in costumes that are that are afraid to enforce laws established to prevent what we all witnessed. They should stick to writing tickets in order to keep the judge's cape dry clean.
No, if it were
jump drunks at the local bar,
The store that was looted the most aggressively was the Walgreens. The restaurant that was burnt down first was the McDonald's. Just to distinguish, those are national chains. Yep. And even though the McDonald's was a franchise, the fact is that there is no employee that should be asked to risk their life to defend property. So I can understand why there were no employees in the Walgreens or in the McDonald's keeping the looters from torching it.
But the police stood there and watched it in their costumes.
Side note of that.
Stood there.
Those are national franchises. Side note, how likely are they to rebuild that in that area?
Yeah.
I mean, what?
Zero.
Yeah.
Zero.
I mean,
zero.
So you've done nothing to help your area. You've actually hurt your area. You've taken jobs away from people.
You've destroyed your credibility. That was the reason why when Jesse Jackson and the other black activists moved into Ferguson and tried to turn this into the same kind of cause they did with the belligerent kid down there in Florida, Trayvon Martin, and how the president tried to play politics with it. that I knew that this is the wrong call, because this kid, like Trayvon Martin, was not a victim. And it was obvious that he was not a victim. And by, even if you're protesting on behalf of a bad kid, and these bad kids, both of them, making horrible decisions, you do a lot of harm to your cause. But when you go the next step and then you actually commit crimes, you steal, you shoot guns in public places, you torch buildings, then all we learned from Ferguson that there's something deeply wrong in the African American community.
Well, you know, there's something
we want to stain every African American with this, but no. But I want to tell you, it was, we witnessed the same thing in New Orleans.
I don't know if you guys are aware of it, but there was a kid, Dylan Taylor, about the same age, white kid, shot out in Utah, fatally shot by a black officer on September 3rd. There's been no big outcry about that.
No.
You know, because
there
the
should
white
be an outcry.
Community,
there was a
generally as a
place,
whole.
Yeah.
Don't care about the criminals. You know, I mean, that's just the truth. If a white criminal is taken off the streets, and I don't, if he's shot, most people really don't care. We, in fact, there's a collective sigh of relief in the white community. Now, I'll say this one last thing, then I got to go. What this show is about is exposing Babylon and why there would be a bunch of people out protesting that Babylon is screwed up is beyond me. Of course it's screwed up. You know, but you're not going to fix it.
It is true that the police in America are screwed up. And so is the Justice Department. It is really screwed up. And so is this integration of federal police, is the point Glenn was making, and local police, and the jurisdiction of the feds, and how they hold sway over the local police. We have become a dictatorship as a nation, concentrated power, and continuing to deprive the individual of rights. And the way that the feds will go about trying to fix their perceived problem here is to exacerbate it, to concentrate more power, to give more power to the Department of Justice.
That man was pathetic. He was out there saying he was angry. That's what he was doing.
It was the closest that I have come to destroying a television set in probably 20 years. I was that angry. I was so angry. I was screaming at the television set, and had it not been for the fact that we just rebuilt a cabinet so we could replace it with a new format size, I would have destroyed it. I mean, I was repulsed. I mean, I just kept on saying, you are a revolting moron. You are exactly the reason that we have these problems. You are fanning the flames of these problems. You are such a scumbag. First, he was inarticulate. He rambled on for 20 minutes. He said nothing that was legitimate. His comment that it feels inequitable, and you realize that, you know, I've done the research, and he's done it too. And we know that over 9 times in 10 when an African-American is killed, that he's killed by a fellow African-American, we know that. We know that that most crime is race on race, is white killing a white, black killing a black, Hispanic killing a Hispanic. That's the majority of crime. But when you get into the minority area and there's two races involved and you want to make it a racial issue, which is what he's trying to fan up here, then you're dealing with eight times more likely that an African American is going to shoot and kill or rape or rob a white than the other way around. And so it doesn't feel inequitable. It is inequitable, but the opposite way that he is trying to protest here. And why would anyone, like a president of the United States, say, I understand and you have a right to be angry? Why would you be angry? you have 12 individuals who heard the testimony of 60 people over 70 hours during 25 days and examined a mountain of forensic evidence and rendered a verdict that is consistent with that evidence, and you have a right to be angry? On what? On behalf of a non-victim? This kid's not a victim. Oh, I was so angry at the president last night.
But you know, but there's an upside here, and the upside is that like Trayvon Martin, they've added a new icon to the civil rights movement. This time,
another
bully and a
another
cigar
thug.
Thief.
Yeah,
just lovely. You know, that's who I'd want to represent me. You know, I know that. You know, so.
Well,
whoa.
A couple of things. This hands up, don't shoot thing is bogus because there's
right.
a big difference between hands up, standing still, and hands up, lunging forward. You know,
well, if he was walking forward, it wouldn't matter because
yeah,
he got within one foot of the
hands up moving. Is right. Hands up moving is very different than hands up standing still.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we're going to consider when we return Wilson's testimony of exactly what he said and what Michael Brown said in response. And it most certainly is, don't shoot. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We've got Glenn on the line. We're talking about the incidents in Ferguson. Glenn, if you don't mind, I happen to agree with your point, but I think since the news last night is the release of the testimony, I'd like to go through some of the testimony and get your comments on it.
Sure.
Wilson told the grand jury that he initially encountered Brown after a friend walking in the street told when he told them to move to the sidewalk, drawing an expletive from Brown. Now, that contradicts most of the early rumors where in fact I had two callers correct me on this show, and I said that, you know, that Brown or Officer Wilson had been with a family with a sick child. And that he had heard the call, because they all carry their radios on their hips, that he had heard the call about a convenience store being robbed, about the owner being assaulted, and that call provided not only a description of the perpetrators, but their apparel, as well as what they stole. A very comprehensive lookout for these guys. The cap they were wearing, the size of the and race of the assailants, and what they stole, and where the store was located, and what direction they were heading. And so Wilson stayed with the family of the sick child until the ambulance came and took the child away. Pretty class. And then he left. He drove in that direction because he'd overheard this. And so all of those who said that Wilson confronted them and was too aggressive initially and had no idea that these were the reported abusers and thieves, that's not true. Wilson said that he recognized their appearance, their apparel, and he saw the box of cigars in the hands, which was the stolen item. And so that's why he pulled up next to them, and rather than having the confrontation in the middle of the street, said, could you please move over to the sidewalk? So far, Wilson's doing the right thing, and Michael Brown is in the wrong. And he says, when I saw the handful of cigars, he says, it clicked for me. These were the suspects in the theft at the convenience store that occurred minutes earlier. Wilson said that he asked the dispatcher to send additional officers, which is the other thing that we were criticizing him for. We said, you know, why didn't he call for backup? He said, Wilson said he asked the dispatcher to send additional officers, then backed his vehicle in front of Brown and his friend and tried to open the door. Wilson said that Brown slammed it back shut. Wilson said he pushed Brown with the door, and Brown hit him in the face. Wilson, and he has, there are three contusions on his face you can see in the close-up pictures. Wilson told the grand jurors that he was thinking, what do I do? What do I do not to get beaten inside of my car? A lot of negatives there. Wilson said that he drew his gun and threatened to shoot Brown if he didn't move back, fearing another punch to the face could knock me out or worse. This is the first place where I have a strong objection. And you and I have talked about this on a previous show. I don't want
About the type of weapons.
Right, right. I would prefer that the first response for a cop is the pistol version of the pepper gun. They shoot, they hold 10 to 12 rounds, they shoot reasonably long range, and they incapacitate an individual. And I would want various versions of stun guns. And I don't mind that they have a pistol with regular ammunition, although I think I'd prefer rubber bullets in the car, but it should be under a safety device so that, I mean, Brown got killed because he was trying to take the officer's gun. If the officer didn't have a gun, no one's dead.
Well, he wasn't trying to take it at the time he was killed, but he tried to take it when they were in the car. Now, just to pause momentarily on this topic, this opens a huge Pandora's box or kettle of fish, whatever metaphor you prefer, because this is an existing issue. It's been an issue in Britain. They've wrestled with this. We're going to wrestle with it here. Plus, the very issue of when a police officer may even defend himself is becoming to the light now.
Agreed. And when it is appropriate for a police officer to defend himself, when he should retreat, is an issue. Should you shoot a gun in an urban area with the chance of injuring bystanders? We'll be back.